from Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. Now, let me start this first show of the new year with a resolution of sorts. See if this has been happening to you as well. Too often, lately, you see a headline or hear a news story that provokes outrage. Maybe you share it on social media or discuss it at the dinner table. And this makes perfect sense. This is as important a time as any to be informed and engaged in what's happening all around us. The trouble is, it's all too easy to get overwhelmed by outrage, to feel isolated and alienated from the many people who seem to believe the exact opposite of what you believe, and ultimately, to get so frustrated that any action you could take seems futile. That's an exhausting and ultimately counterproductive outcome. Getting clicks at all costs is a big part of the internet economy. It feeds the outrage industry. The same goes for what truly deserves to be called fake news. Stories generated to advance a political agenda, truth be damned. And all of this amplifies an already fevered environment of hostility, fear, and rage. So, here's that resolution I mentioned. When the mandate of State of Belief Radio calls for us to cover stories that we know are likely to generate outrage, we will work hard to include action steps to make sure we're giving listeners something of value and not just feeding frustration. We will make it a priority to highlight stories of inspired cooperation across various lines of division. And we will continue to amplify voices that would otherwise all too often go unheard. Friends, we're determined to do this for your sake and for our own. In the long run, being outraged all the time means that to survive, one is likely to lose one's capacity for outrage. Like the Republican lawmakers who this past week looked the other way while the leader of their party, the president of this nation, joked bluntly about the size of America's nuclear button. I just can't believe they are all so inhuman as to simply not care about so monstrous a statement. I choose to think that bit by bit, step by step, outrage by outrage, they have grown numb to the fearsome danger each and every one of us lives in so long as things remain as they are. But waking up requires taking a step back, refocusing on what's truly important in our own lives, seeking out examples of resilience and courage, and then stepping out once more without the cynicism that is so often the one shield that can help protect us from outrage overload. Look, I want you to hold me, to hold us to this commitment. Contact information is available at stateofbelief.com. Please use it to let us know if you think we're falling into the outrage industry trap. And equally important in this new year, tell us what you need to hear on this show. What are the questions that we can work on answering together? What are the subjects you would like to hear addressed in the State of Belief way? I'm really looking forward to hearing from you in 2018. Here is a chance for us to work together and better the dialogue on this show and perhaps better the dialogue in our nation. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide. and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. And now, more than ever, we need you to join our other generous listeners who make this show possible. For information on making a tax-deductible donation, please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
President Trump weighed in on Twitter last night about the cold snap bracing much of the country, and he seemed dismissive yet again about the effects of climate change.
A freak winter storm is slamming the eastern parts of the United States, causing at least 12 deaths in four different states.
The President of the United States may have tweeted something snarky in response to forecasts of bitterly cold weather. But the instability we've been seeing is being taken seriously by many, including many people of faith. On this week's show, you'll hear about the response coming from a group called Young Evangelicals for Climate Action.
This whole election is being rigged.
You vote twice, you get 5 years in the slammer.
This is voter suppression.
And they are cooking the ballot boxes on Election Day.
That's not about black and white. That's about right and wrong.
And you would think that Jim Crow rose from the dead.
I don't know how it became impossible to point to voter suppression efforts without being called a sore loser. After all, it was the sitting president who branded his winning election, quote, rigged. The meticulous work of investigating efforts to disenfranchise voters falls to journalists like New York Times bestselling author Greg Palast. And he will join us for an update.
I don't say homosexuality is an abomination, Mr. President. The Bible does.
At least that's what it's been saying for the past 70 years or so, since the word never appeared in an English translation before that. We'll take a look at this truth with researcher Kathy Baldock. But first, self-examination can be one of the most painful things a person or a movement can attempt to do. But it's also nothing less than essential in many situations. A challenging article that appeared recently in Religion Dispatches magazine was headlined, "A Ray of Hope," and the author, Reverend Peter Larman, who joins me right now on State of Belief Radio. Peter, Happy New Year and welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Happy New Year to you. It's good to be back, Walden.
For many years, you were the executive director of Progressive Christians Uniting. The criticisms that you spell out are coming from someone who knows this world very well and cares about it. I read you as saying, too many in the progressive faith community are letting themselves off too easily. Is that part of it?
That is part of it, Welton. And I want to say that I plead guilty to the indictment that I lodged in that I've been part of what I criticized here. But let me try to say what the main point is. My point of departure is the current time, you know, the Trump time that has brought out the resistance, as it's known, including faith-based resistance. Mm-hmm. And I write that for many in progressive faith communities, this is sort of a shocking new revelation, the mm-hmm. Trumpocalypse, as some call it. And I try to say, well, in fact, Trump reveals what was always there in our history. Mm-hmm. And it's hard sometimes to face that. But what was always there is this toxic blend, call it tribalism now, but this toxic blend of a kind of twisted Christianity and white supremacy and class oppression mm-hmm. all rolled into one big bundle of oppression. And I firmly believe that that is the sort of inner story of our history, which is very difficult to face up. I mean, I'm a white male, grew up in the Midwest. I believed in the American dream. I still do believe in the American dream, but it's the American dream of the people who've been, one might say, part of the resistance forever. Then I go on to say that I think too many people in the religious left, and I include myself, we do a kind of performative politics. We make a show of our opposition, but it really is a show. That is to say, we sign statements, we show up at prayer vigils, we may go so far as to write letters to the editor. That's not nothing. And I do say that's not nothing, mm-hmm. but it's not enough mm-hmm. now. It's not enough now when the fat's in the fire. And when younger people, many of them from faith traditions, but many not from faith traditions, are kind of instructing us on how to do resistance at a deeper level, mm-hmm. How to base power from the bottom up, mm-hmm. how to be fearless, how to name the evil combination of race and class, mm-hmm. and even to say that, here I'm speaking mainly of white Christianity, that white Christianity is complicit and has been complicit in this insofar as we accept and even sometimes worship laissez-faire capitalism. We actually believe, whether we admit it or not, that wealthy people are somehow better, morally better, otherwise they wouldn't be rich. I end on a hopeful note because I think some of the young people are actually, and I use a strong word there, converting
sure.
us older folks in a way that's needed and timely.
Peter, I'm really interested in what you say about this idea that it's a mistake to think of the current era as disconnected from our history. And I want you to talk about that and what the impact of ignoring our past on these issues may be?
Well, I think everyone who is serious about change understands that history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. And so going back to the colonial enterprise, and that's not just North America, but South America as well, Europeans presume the right to name and occupy the spaces they visited. They were guests, but they sort of presumed to be proprietors. And part of that naming became racialized over time. I've been entranced, and I can't recommend it highly enough, and I do read a lot of history, a professor at Yale Divinity School named Willie James Jennings wrote a book about the diseased moral imagination of Christianity and how it's been profoundly hurt by its participation in this naming and shaming and oppression, appropriation and enslavement and all the rest of it. It's oppression of people of color. And the way in which Christianity got implicated in this is through an elaborated form of supersessionism. Usually we think of supersessionism as Christians presuming that they now hold the place of Israel in God's eyes. But the supersessionism that Professor Jennings talks about goes still further in terms of the claim by the white colonizers, the white Christian colonizers, to be doing God's work in expropriating lands and enslaving peoples. Mm-hmm. It's a sad story. Jennings tells it incredibly well, but he also says, there is hope. There is always hope to recover what the essence of Christianity is, which is our common belonging, our shared humanity and the respect for lands and peoples and difference. Mm-hmm. It's hard. It's a hard read, and all these books are hard reads. But I think it's necessary, and I think there's a source of power for us in it if we understand it, because that way we can not forget that in where I live in Southern California, the challenge of people finding a way forward has to do with racial justice, but it has fundamentally to do with economic justice as well.
Peter, in the progressive community, who do you see that, in your opinion, is getting it right? Where can we look for good role models of the approach that you're advocating?
Well, I'm in touch with a whole bunch of people under the umbrella of the Interfaith Organizing Network. The Interfaith Organizing Network, or IOI, Interfaith Organizing Initiative, was originally supporting what's called faith-based community organizing, and it was backed by a group of interfaith funders. That project has sort of come to a bit of an end, and now the Interfaith Organizing Initiative has begun to focus on a state-by-state basis in terms of how you do build power involving the communities that are most impacted by the mass incarceration regime and by the degradation of the workplace and by, you know, privatization of public services. So in Ohio and so forth, there's work that's going to crest this year, and people are putting a lot of energy into that. I also want to point to the very young people, and I admire how this organization has changed. You recall Soul Force, Mel White. Soul Force was very militant in terms of bearing witness against Jerry Falwell and folks like that around the homophobic policies and homophobic religion. They're still sort of at that, but now they focus on this fusion of white male-dominated Christianity and class oppression, and they've done a critique. And it's a wonderful training critique of how this works out. And it's, again, I use that word conversion. I was skeptical because I'm an old person. I'm like, what do young people have to teach me? These people are amazing. They're brilliant trainers and organizers. So I see hope around that. Prince. Now, these are people who are not conventional churchgoers by any means, but they get what the liberatory gospel is about in their work on white Christian supremacy, as they call it. It's wonderful work. St. Augustine said that hope has two lovely daughters, courage and anger. All of it peaceful, all of it nonviolent, all of it grounded in what we would consider the highest ethical values, but still righteous anger, which is different from snark. This is the kind of anger that roots people in God's future. And courage, of course, because none of this is easy. And it's possible, you know, that you will lose friends. But more power to them, more power to us. What Trump represents may be old news, but this is a new era in confronting it.
Yeah. Reverend Peter Larman is a longtime justice activist who until recently served as executive director of Progressive Christians Uniting in Los Angeles. Previously, Peter was senior minister of New York's Judson Memorial Church from 1994 to 2004. Peter, thank you so much for being with us again on State of Belief Radio, where you're always welcome.
Always a pleasure, Welton, and I wish all of your listeners the best of the new year.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. You'll hear researcher Kathy Baldock on just when the word homosexual first appeared in a Bible translation and the impact that's had. Also, how have ongoing efforts at voter suppression influenced recent elections? And what's coming up in November? I'll ask investigative journalist Greg Pallast. And up next, Young Evangelicals for Climate Action. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. In many quarters, it's become conventional wisdom that people of faith reject climate science. Like so many other generalizations, that's far from accurate. Many religious organizations and individuals are working hard on the issue, and a leading force among them is Young Evangelicals for Climate Action. I'm joined right now by national organizer and spokesperson Kyle Marid Skop. Kyle, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
What does the organization do, and how did it get started?
The mission of Young Evangelicals for Climate Action is to educate and mobilize young Christians around the country to overcome the climate crisis as part of our Christian witness and discipleship. We believe it's part and parcel of what it means to be a Christian. to take action to address climate change. And it got started in 2012 out of a recognition that there were a lot of young people of faith coming of age, perhaps maybe beginning to think about voting in their first or their second election, and not really having a leg to stand on when it came to integrating what they were learning when it came to earth science and physics and the science of climate change in mm-hmm. particular, and what they had grown up in the church learning. Many of them had been told that when it came to climate change, they either needed to check their faith or their brain at the door. And that was a false choice. And many people, many young people of faith were coming to understand that. And what Young Evangelicals for Climate Action is trying to do is to create a third way, a way for us to integrate a deep appreciation for science as one of the ways that God reveals himself to us. Mm-hmm. And with our deep faith commitments to love God by caring for the world that he made and loved, and by loving our neighbor, who are put at risk by the effects of climate change, particularly our vulnerable neighbors around the world.
Tell us, if you will, one or two achievements that you can highlight for our listeners.
A few years ago, the Evangelical Environmental Network and Young Evangelicals for Climate Action were instrumental in working with the EPA in passing the mercury air toxins standard. This was a rule issued by the EPA that dramatically reduced the levels of mercury that are allowed to be emitted and to be present in the ambient environment. And it was hailed by various medical associations across the board as a major public health achievement. We know that mercury has devastating and lasting health impacts, particularly for the unborn. And so, you know, even a couple years after the standard was passed, we started to see mercury levels plummeting, and we started to see public health outcomes improving, particularly in newborn health, mm-hmm. the health of mothers and young children, which I think we can all agree is a huge success.
Oh, yes.
Another success that Young Evangelicals in particular really spearheaded was at the end of 2013 and heading into 2014, the National Association of Evangelicals, which represents dozens of denominations and tens of millions of evangelical Christians across the country, still didn't have an official position statement on climate change. Mm-hmm. They had a position statement on the importance of caring for creation as evangelical Christians, but we thought that it was important for the largest evangelical association in the country to speak clearly and definitively about the gospel implications around climate change. And so Young Evangelicals for Climate Action launched a letter-writing campaign. We wrote into the executive committee of the board for the National Association of Evangelicals and basically said, look, because you all did such a good job raising us in the church, you as our elders in the faith tradition, because you did such a good job raising us in the church, we care about the church's witness. We care about what the church has to say about issues that affect our neighbors and that affect the world. And as such, we want you to take a strong, clear position on climate change. And because of that campaign and other forces working together at the same time, the National Association of Evangelicals adopted an official position statement on climate change, naming it as a reality, as a threat, and as something that the church needs to take seriously. So those are a couple examples that come to mind.
Cal, when a political leader as popular with evangelicals as Donald Trump makes light of climate issues, what does that do for building consensus around needed action and bringing on board more people to work with you?
Yeah, well, I think it's important to parse a little bit of that statement. The president is popular with white self-identified evangelicals, and these are people who are willing to self-identify with pollsters. So it's very, very, very tricky, and I'm trying not to make excuses necessarily, but it is very important to parse out exactly who we talk about when we talk about evangelicals who are supportive of the president, because the evangelical community is very diverse. A full 25% of the U.S. evangelical community are people of color. So it's important that we keep in mind that the evangelical community is diverse, especially when it comes to the issue of climate change. So, you know, we don't necessarily see the president as a threat. We've in fact seen that since the election, we've had a lot of evangelicals come forward and kind of be forced off the fence. I think in a lot of ways with past administrations, it had been easy for evangelicals to say, well, whether or not climate change is real or not, there are more or less the right people in the right offices doing more or less the right things. But now the reality has become much starker. Mm-hmm. And so evangelicals are starting to say, look, I can't kind of sit back anymore. I have to do my research. I have to think biblically about this, and I have to figure out what I can and need to do to address this, because it's no longer the case that the federal government is kind of moving this forward. And that's good news, because even though, you know, more or less the right people were doing the right things beforehand, they weren't doing enough and they weren't going far enough. And so in a lot of ways, the new political reality in this country has catalyzed a grassroots movement that had been rather dormant. And that's also true in the evangelical church when it comes to climate change.
Kyle, please take just a moment. We don't have much time left, but take a moment to tell our listeners about how they can get involved with Young Evangelicals for Climate Action and how they can support your work.
Yeah, thanks for that. Anyone and everyone with an internet connection can go to yecaction.org, read about what we're about. You can sign our call to action, whether you're a young evangelical or not. Signing our call to action will get you plugged into our communications. You'll get newsletters. You'll get periodic opportunities to take action. For instance, right now, there's an opportunity to submit a comment to the EPA about their proposed repeal of the Clean Power Plan. You can find a tab to donate if that's the way that you'd like to get involved with the movement. You can also find my email on the website and send me an email and just say, this is who I am. This is how I'd like to get involved. I'd love to plug you into some of our leaders on the ground across the country, see if we can get you plugged into one of our communities around the nation.
Kyle Mardskop is national organizer and spokesperson with Young Evangelicals for Climate Action. As much of the country is reeling from dangerous winter weather, I appreciate the work you're doing, Kyle. Thanks for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks for having me on.
There's more to come on this week's show. We'll look at voter suppression with investigative journalist Greg Pallast, and later author Kathy Baldock on how homophobia turned up in the Bible. If you miss any part of today's show, you can hear full episodes of State of Belief anytime on our website. You'll also find links to the topics we discussed this week, extended interviews and transcripts, and archive of past shows, all of that at stateofbelief.com. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, religion and radio done differently. What do you do when the President of the United States cries foul about an election that he actually won? Well, if you're an investigative journalist, Greg Pallast, you don't let yourself get distracted, and you just keep at it. Fortunately, Greg Pallast has agreed to give us a few minutes to come back on our show. Greg, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Welton.
As if this issue weren't complicated enough, the man who won the election called it rigged. You say it was rigged, but not in the way Donald Trump means. Explain that, if you will.
Yeah, it's real simple. Donald Trump was correct. The election was rigged, and his cronies rigged it. What I mean by that is that there were at least 1.1 million voters wrongly removed from the voter rolls. Americans who had the right to vote but were removed. Why? Well, Donald Trump and his cronies, in particular a guy named Chris Kobach, who is the Secretary of State of Kansas and until this week was head of Trump's Commission on so-called voter integrity. Mm-hmm. He not only accused people of voting twice, which is a crime, he did something else. He actually produced a list of 3 million names of people he claimed voted twice. Now, what's strange is that the U.S. media has said, oh, it's a crazy statement that people have voted twice. There's no evidence of this. He's a fool. Ha, ha, ha. They're all fools. Well, there's nothing funny about it because, in fact, they did create a list of 3 million voters. And oddly, I'm the only journalist that tried to get the list. They didn't want me to get the list, but I got it. That's why I'm an investigative reporter. They try to turn it down. But I have the list of people that Donald Trump accused of voting twice, 3 million of them, and close to 1 million of them had their voter registrations blocked by this crazy accusation. That's a story that has not appeared in the U.S. mainstream press. And I got to tell you, this grab for votes, this blocking legal and legitimate voters, is what made Donald Trump president, because he not only lost the popular vote, in fact, in key states, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Ohio, if you allowed people to vote, were blocked from voting, if you counted votes that were disqualified, another shame of American elections, Trump didn't win. He did not win.
Greg, why in the world would mainline media in the United States not pick up that kind of information and run with it?
Well, they do pick it up just years later. I mean, back in the year 2000, I was the only reporter who got my hands on a list of voters that Catherine Harris, then the Secretary of State of Florida, mm-hmm. used to remove tens of thousands of black voters from the voter rolls. She called them felons, criminals, not allowed to vote. That was in the year 2000. That's what elected George Bush. Remember, he became president by just 537 votes in the state of Florida. But that 537 vote margin was entirely attributed to the thousands of black folk not allowed to vote because they were wrongly accused of being felons. By the way, on the list of 56,000 felons that I got from Catherine Harris's office, not one, not a single one, not one was a felon illegal voter, but they were black, and I know they're black because it said BLA next to the names of the majority of those who were removed. Now, why do I bring up that case? Well, I just read for the first time in the New York Times a few months ago about the wrongful removal of black voters accused of being felons. That was reported by the New York Times. It just took them 16 years to do it. And this is true of all my investigations. Every time I do an investigation of vote theft in America, the mainstream media has again and again re-reported my stories. It simply takes years before they get around to it.
Why is it so suspect in so many circles to even mention this data? You have the hard data. There is actual evidence, and yet when Hillary Clinton, for example, made just a passing reference to voter suppression, she was ridiculed from all sides. Why are we so unwilling to face the truth about our elections?
In America, what we have to do is maintain a myth. And you see this in many areas. After all, we have a Martin Luther King holiday, so just, you know, shut up, right? And our U.S. Supreme Court said that Jim Crow, that official Jim Crow tactics are no longer used in America. So we have this myth. Even Hillary Clinton herself said no American presidential candidate has ever challenged the veracity of the vote. And of course, that means that she forgot all about the fact that in fact, Al Gore did go to the Supreme Court and say that the election was stolen. He just backed off after their ruling. So we have an American myth. I'm allowed, for example, on radio, for example, to talk about something called vote suppression. You know, but if your car is stolen, Reverend, you don't say, my car has been suppressed. You say your car has been stolen. So I use the term vote theft. I do not like to use the term vote suppression because no one knows what it means. It's very sanitary and it's nonsense. People's votes weren't suppressed. People's votes were stolen. And so because I won't accept the idea that, as Hillary Clinton also said and Joe Biden said, American elections are the envy of the world. And that means that Biden has only been to Kazakhstan.
Do you think it's possible that the most privileged members of our society, the white males who are being challenged for the first time, are so attached to power that they would rather see our democracy itself destroyed so they can hold on to power rather than share power and privilege with anyone else? Is that a possibility?
I wouldn't say that it's white males as a group, because I saw a lot of white males in Dayton, Ohio, and others who lost their jobs in auto plants. And I think that there is absolutely a class problem in America. And basically, we have a ruling class, and whether it's Democrat or Republican, that keeps getting reelected. It doesn't matter what their party label is. It is a certain ruling class which is very happy with the system as it exists. After all, the party of incumbency got elected under the current biased rules, which still have a huge element of Jim Crow. So that this elite, yes, the elite would rather have privilege than democracy. But it's not necessarily white males. In fact, I would say one of the reasons we don't hear screaming from Hillary Clinton is that Clinton is part of that privileged set very much. So is Joe Biden. These are the landlords of the planet, and they're not unhappy even if they lose an election or if one of their members of their club wins or the other. The important thing is that the club always wins. Because one of the other questions that come right out of this, of course, is where are the Democrats? Well, You'd have a very different Democratic Party if everyone got to vote. I saw some of the worst vote theft or vote suppression done by Hispanic Democrats in New Mexico to block other poor Hispanic Democrats. So an elite Hispanic Democratic group, including a female Secretary of State who then was charged with crimes for illegal vote suppression. So it's not even one party versus another, but right at the moment, it happens to be that the Republicans are far better at this game than Democrats. But Democrats are not going to complain because you'd have a very different Democratic Party if they let every poor Democrat of any color vote.
Greg, what do you see as most threatening in terms of November 2018?
Wow. The most threatening thing is the failure to face the fact that we have massive vote suppression in the United States. You know, I talked about this system of saying voters have voted in two states at once, a crime, and they're removing hundreds of thousands of voters, but not arresting any for this crime. There's a simple fact of not counting votes. We have a little secret in America called spoilage, in which votes are simply not counted. I'm not talking about some guy in a cave changing the numbers in computers at the last minute. I'm talking about votes literally thrown in the garbage can. For example, in Detroit, in the last election, Donald Trump supposedly won by 10,000 votes. But 75,000 votes, that is about seven times Trump's supposed margin, those ballots were simply thrown out because they weren't counted by machines. Where were the machines that didn't count them? The 88 machines broke down. They were almost all in Detroit and Flint, Michigan, two African-American cities. So basically, votes never got counted from Detroit. That's not Trump town. Motown is not Trump town, and they would have ended up as Hillary's votes. They didn't get counted, and that's what gave Trump Michigan. And you had similar stories, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and elsewhere. And I see this repeating in 2018, and worse, because while liberals are making fun of, and the establishment press making fun of Trump's statements that there are millions of illegal voters and millions of alien voters, they are not uncovering and not going after the fact that these accusations are being used to remove, block, and disqualify the votes of American voters That's what we have to worry about, that there's nothing being done. This week, Trump disbanded his commission on vote theft, supposedly. Mm-hmm. But he moved the process into the Department of Homeland Security, mm-hmm. where it is now safe from Freedom of Information requests. So they're going to be working on stealing the vote, suppressing the vote, in the Department of Homeland Security, which is a black box, which is a secret operation. That is could not be more dangerous.
Goodness.
Greg, before we go, I want you to talk a little bit more about your film and tell our listeners how they can get a look at it.
The film is The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, The Case of the Stolen Election. It's been updated, and it's out now this week, which is available on Amazon and the usual suspects. Or you can go to gregpalace.com to catch a trailer and get more information. It's a documentary. It follows me on my investigation of this vote heist in 2016, warns you about 18. And while it is a pretty darn serious subject, I guarantee you'll laugh at the beginning of the film. There's a lot of humor in it. And you'll cry at the end. If you don't laugh at the beginning, cry at the end, I'll pay for your therapy, by the way. That's a guarantee. Because it tells you, it goes into the details. It shows you these lists of so-called double voters. It shows you the people they call alien voters who happen to be dark-skinned Americans. It shows you, and you get to meet the billionaires. This is the key thing, Weldon. I show you and confront the billionaires behind Trump. Remember, he only plays a billionaire on TV. Trump's no billionaire. The real billionaires behind him, we confront them and show you how they've been manipulating our elections. And that's the story of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy.
Greg Palast is an award-winning filmmaker, a New York Times best-selling author, and a tireless investigative journalist whose work can be found in Rolling Stone magazine, on BBC television, and elsewhere. Greg, it's always informative to talk with you, as well as enjoyable to be with you again. Thanks for being with us once again on State of Belief Radio, and thanks for giving up some of your vacation time to do so.
Thank you, Reverend. You're the best.
Now, this is one of those topics that require a lot more time than we've got available on this show. So it's important that you read my next guest writing on how and when the term homosexual first appeared in an English language translation of the Bible. But to whet your appetite, I'm happy to welcome Kathy Baldock to State of Belief Radio. Kathy, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you. And there's a lot of curiosity about the research I'm doing right now, so thank you for being willing to share it.
You're an evangelical Christian who outgrew the harsh anti-gay rhetoric so common in American evangelical circles, and you became an advocate. Is that a fair description?
Yes, and it all happened through relationship. Through a hiking partner I met on the hiking trails. I live in the High Sierra, right near hiking trails. And while I was going through a divorce, the way I coped with it, the way I processed, was to hike every day. And I started hiking with a lesbian. And, well, she was suspect to me from my evangelical bubble, but we became friends. And she's my best friend now, 17 years later.
So how long did that take, the whole transition for you?
The process, it took her a year to come out to me because she knew I was a Christian. So therefore, that equated that I would not be accepting of her. And then it took, even after she came out, it took another 5 years before I even decided to look at the theology on this, because I thought the worlds were so separate. Gay people didn't like Christians. Didn't like gay people. I would be the nice guy and be in the middle, but now I never challenged my theology. And about 6 years into the relationship, I challenged my theology, and I was pretty surprised at what the Bible did not say.
Yeah.
So, Kathy, what led you to look at this one word and the way it first turns up in an English language translation of the Bible?
So I wrote a book in 2014, Walking the Bridgeless Canyon, and it's a history of the cultural and religious discrimination against the LGBT community in America. And I teach very regularly on this topic. I typically do, my preferred way of teaching is a 6-hour seminar. And as I teach, one of the pieces I teach is the history of understanding human sexuality. And because I'm so familiar with the timeline of when the word homosexuality was invented, 1868, and it made it into a long progression, shortened story. It didn't even make it into an English dictionary out of a medical dictionary. It was in a medical dictionary in 1901. Didn't make it into Merriam-Webster's until 1934. And people weren't using it within community widely. And people certainly didn't understand what it was. And then the medical community, the psychiatric community, had a time where they were trying to struggle to understand what homosexuality was and who these people were. And so there was no understanding, certainly, that it was a sexual orientation. It was seen as a perversion. It was seen as some kind of wrong erotic sex, as was some forms of heterosexuality that had eroticism attached to it and were not intent towards procreation. So I knew all of this. So when I would teach, and I would get to talking about the first time homosexuality appeared in the Bible, I would say, I believe that this was a cultural and ideological translation of these two Greek words, arsenikoite and malakoi. And I would say this time after time after time. And then finally someone came to me, his name is Ed Oxford, and he said to me, would you like to prove that? I said, well, I don't know how to prove it because all these people are dead. And he said, well, the head of the translation team was a guy named Luther Weigel, and he was the dean of Yale Divinity during the time the translation was done.
Which translation are we talking about?
The Revised Standard Version.
Okay.
And so all of his notes, not just his translation notes, they were all housed at Yale. So we thought, well, why don't we put all our paperwork in and try to get access to these microfilms and to these paper documents and see if we can find some sort of thinking or conversation or exchange on why they translated arsenikoite, which really meant the best word for it would be a pederast, or somebody that abuses another male sexually, and malakos, which really means a man that takes on the nasty qualities of a woman, including penetration, like she's a deceiver, and she's lustful, and she's slothful and lazy and unchaste, all those qualities of a woman in ancient cultures. And why did the team of 12 decide to combine those words and come up with the word homosexual?
Were you surprised by what you found?
I was shocked. I was so surprised in his intensely detailed notes on all these words. They were looking at the King James, the American Standard Version, and the English Standard Version, and they were saying, what words are we going to change in those versions in the RSV? And he kept meticulous, ongoing notes and lists. And in absolutely none of those lists was the word homosexual. We couldn't find any record of a conversation about these two words becoming homosexual. And I'll tell you, I went through 22 rolls of microfilm. We went through 22 rolls of microfilm that had on an average of 2,000 sheets of paper on each roll and all those boxes of paper archives. And there was no conversation. And finally, we found on the third day, we found an exchange of three letters back and forth from a young seminarian to Dr. Weigel, challenging him as to why he translated arsenikoite and malakos to homosexual. And this young man, a seminarian, laid out the most unbelievable case as if he knew what we know today and were transported back 65 years. And it was a shocking conversation. And Dr. Weigel answered why he he allowed that translation, and it was ideological and cultural, and his theology behind it was weak, and he didn't understand human sexuality. Nobody understood human sexuality at the time. There were a lot of myths about it, and my assumption was right.
So what was the date of the first appearance of that word, homosexuality, in a translation of the English Bible?
This was the first English translation in over 50 years, and everybody cared about it. I guess we're at a time in the culture where people cared about it. Front page of the New York Times, cover of different magazines, secular magazines, people were talking about it. And in absolutely zero of those articles did anybody say, oh, look, this is the first time this word homosexual has appeared. It was so under the radar, nobody noticed it. Because what they were trying to translate, or what the meaning they were trying to get across in this translation, was this is about sexual perversion. And at that time in history, in medical history, in cultural history, in legal history, homosexuality was not an orientation. It was a perversion. And we have to remember that this was on like the tail end of this time of trying to understand human sexuality. And in the turn of the century, if people were being sexual with an erotic desire, a passion attached to it, that was seen as a perversion. I'm talking about heterosexuals. And so if they were having sex with an erotic passion attached to it and no intention to procreate, that was seen even for heterosexuals as perverted.
How much has that colored the whole negative approach to homosexuality, and what are we going to do about it?
The book I'm working on now, I started thinking about, well, what did the other translation teams do subsequently? How did they look at these two words? Where are their notes? And so the simplest way to say it is, as we knew better about what human sexuality is, what homosexuality is, what sexual orientation is, as we knew those things better, did the translation teams go back and revisit those original assumptions? Mm-hmm. And what the record shows is, as time went on and we hit in particular the 70s, the translation of those words, rather than being reinvestigated and reassessed, they doubled down on them. And if the Bible were intended for the conservative evangelical market, because there are translations that are intent to those markets, they made that so clear. And not only did they now, because that was in 1 Corinthians 6, 9 through 10, now they also put it into 1 Timothy and into Romans and into Leviticus. And they included lesbians, which were not part of the first equation. So as the LGBTQ community became more of a, in quotation marks, issue, they increased the number of verses that God supposedly wrote to exclude them. Yeah. So it's a very interesting process as time went on, as we knew better. Did we do better? No.
We have listeners who probably are saying, I wish I could look over Kathy's shoulder as she works on this project. How can they keep up with what you're doing and learn more that way also?
I've always put out a monthly newsletter, but now I'm doing a newsletter that keeps people up to date with a video and with latest work. And they can send an email to newsletters@canyonwalkerconnections.com and ask me to put them on the newsletter, or my email also they can send it to is Kathy@canyonwalkerconnections.com and just say, put me on your monthly newsletter.
Kathy Baldock is an activist and educator and the author of an invaluable series of books on issues of religion and LGBT persons, collectively titled Walking the Bridgeless Canyon. Her ministry of reconciliation is called Canyon Walker Connections, online at www.canyonwalkerconnections.com. Kathy, thanks so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you.
Well, That's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you think there's value in the conversations we present and the voices we amplify in the midst of the gridlock our public rhetoric too often becomes, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. And while you're there, remember to give us your ideas, your suggestions for this show. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Engage in the discussion. We need to hear your voice. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Stay warm. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.